This podcast is intended for investment professionals only. All investing involves risk.
Hello and welcome to this special podcast, which we're recording to take stock of markets after a remarkable shift in the narrative that was prevalent only a few months ago. I'm Max Julius, head of content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, our global CIO, Colin Reedy, head of active strategies, Jason Becker, head of US credit strategy in Chicago, and Tim Drayson, head of economics. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the pod. Well, Sonia, with no further ado, during our podcast in December on the outlook for 2025, you questioned whether markets could bask in yet another year of US exceptionalism. Given the experience of the past 3 months, is the answer a resounding no?
Thanks, Max. And I think we should definitely say the market is questioning whether there is yet again another year of US exceptionalism. But it is worth reminding ourselves what we said in our last call of 2024, because it's very clear that we ended very much on a high. The market very clearly focused very much on all the positives that Trump has shared on the campaign trail and very little on the negatives. And I know Tim will pick these up later. And we're very much focusing on tax cuts, deregulation, and all the nice things that would come with another Trump administration. What is equally important is that markets were building on a continuation of the Goldilocks backdrop, because at the time, as we've discussed, it was very much about a mild deceleration in the US economic backdrop. And of course, with that inflation, yeah, probably stickier. There was a few question marks, but I think the perception was very much that it is under control and that the Fed hence could continue with a relatively supportive journey throughout 2025, though by no means as aggressive as expected back in September 24. Now, the exceptionalism piece actually relates to the fact that the US growth profile has been so extraordinarily strong compared to the rest of the world. So we're focusing a lot on the Mag 7 and the equity markets, but of course, this was all based on an incredibly strong growth profile. And we highlighted in particular that the growth gap between the US and the rest of the world has been widening throughout 2024 and, of course, in the earlier years as well. And so for us, the big question mark has been, can this continue? Is it going to flatten? Is it going to narrow? Because, of course, that is, at the end of the day, the key driver for markets. As long as the US can continue with such a dynamic economic backdrop that will support EPS growth, there's very little we can say why this should derail the market. Now, if you then compare to what happened in the rest of the world, that contrast was even starker because, of course, we know China has had another very difficult year. Now, this is not new news, but of course, there was very little, very positive coming out of China. And Europe was equally unexciting, and we have been watching whether there was anything to look out for. We did highlight actually at the last podcast that we were awaiting the election outcome in Germany. We were looking for the budget situation in France. And so there were a few, you know, trigger areas and trigger focus areas that we wanted to look at. And of course, if you now look at how markets have reacted since the beginning of the year, there seems to be definitely a focus on those outside the US areas. Now, to put it mildly, we had a busy start to 2025. And it looks like the market has definitely been surprised by the speed and the number of executive orders that have been put forward in the very early days of the new Trump administration. And of course, now we're waking up to the possibility that the global impact might be harsher than originally anticipated. It's very important that we are not getting too confused with headlines versus real economy impacts. And Tim will pick this up because that is, at the end of the day, what will drive markets throughout the rest of the year. The market can get very anxious when it comes to a lot of noise, but, you know, over the mid to long term, it will depend on how tariffs, immigration, and then, of course, the expected tax cuts and deregulation will provide the backdrop for the economic growth. Lots of questions about the consumer always have been, has been the backdrop of the US economy. But there are some early signs, and I know Tim will pick this up, but of course there has been hence a lot of, you know, anxiety on where we are heading. If you look at the overall market environment, lots of focus on Mag 7. Tesla, of course, had the almighty swing in terms of up first on the back of the election and then down significantly since the beginning of the year. And that, of course, given their size in the overall indices, is significant. So we have to be very mindful not to read too much into the headline levels, but to understand what's happening underneath. First and foremost, global ex-US equities is up 8% year to date. And that is one that we should note, because it's very clear that the rest of the world is not pricing a US recession. And that it's been more a rotation rather than an outright recessionary call in equity markets. And even within the US, we have seen more of a rotation. So you have seen that there's been some shift out of consumer cyclicals into defensive. So there is some repositioning to acknowledge that the risk backdrop has changed. But as I said, and as I started, we're far away from pricing a US recession. And the exceptionalism piece, I would tie back, are we seeing a significant change in the way we're looking at the US economy, the strength, and how it turns out from here? Because markets is a reaction function. It's not the input. The input is coming down to fundamentals.
Okay, thanks, Sonia. That's really clear. So the sort of Goldilocks fairy tale is over, and we need to look past headlines, both kind of news and index levels as well, really, to understand what's going on. Lots there to unpack over the rest of the call. Probably good to turn to you, Tim, now for a sort of immediate reaction to Sonia's comments there. So, Tim, have markets and your fellow economists, the economist community, sufficiently factored in the consequences of those tariffs Sonia's just mentioned and other policy initiatives coming out of the US?
Well, Max, the simple answer is probably not enough. So Sonia talked about the blizzard of executive orders straight after inauguration. And up until mid-February, economists hadn't changed their forecasts, markets were still buoyant. Since then, we've had a combination of much weaker confidence surveys, both from the consumer and also business. And we've seen clearly an adverse reaction, but mainly focused in the US rather than outside, which is still performing well so far this year. You've seen economists begin to trim their numbers, but I think the adjustment is only partial. So far, they're doing a rather static analysis. So they factored in a somewhat higher average tariff rate on US imports, having previously assumed it would just be China, maybe a bit in autos, but not a broader tariff. But Trump's been talking much more about reciprocal tariffs, and we'll hear more on this on 2nd of April. So economists now assume a high effective tariff rate. They then work out, okay, what does that mean for inflation? What does that mean for real incomes? Take a bit off the consumer. And in aggregate, roughly about 0.5% of those GDP numbers so far. But what they're not doing, and I think this is the crucial area, is really building in a kind of prolonged period of uncertainty, which is likely to weigh on business investment. And it's really hard to model these types of effects. We don't have that many precedents. Typically, uncertainty gets resolved quite quickly if you get a market panic because you get a policy response. But this time around, it's the policy from the administration, which is causing uncertainty. So what is the feedback loop here? I mean, if the economy were to turn down, if markets were to be very weak, perhaps they would roll back some of the tariffs. But as long as people are kind of complacent about the impact, that will just galvanize the administration to push full steam ahead. And the second area of uncertainty is, you know, what is the end goal for these tariffs? Is it just a negotiating tactic? In which case, you can make quite a positive case that it could bring down global tariff rates. But if it's a move towards autarky, self-sufficiency of the US economy, reindustrialization, raising revenues, it's going to be much harder to reach some kind of a trade deal. And therefore, the uncertainty will persist for a lot longer. I've only talked about tariffs so far. There's another several buckets of policy uncertainty. Sonia mentioned the fiscal side. And that was the kind of great hope. We see a repeat of the first Trump administration came in with sweeping tax cuts, particularly for the corporate sector. My personal view is it's going to be quite hard to deliver a net stimulus this time round. Just extending the existing tax cuts is not an additional stimulus to the economy. And the starting point is a very large federal budget deficit of 7% of GDP. Now, I know Congress has kind of been a little bit in the shadows with the White House driving the agenda. There still are one or two deficit hawks out there who will be resistant to
and a big tax cuts unless they're associated with spending restraints. So while I do expect a full extension of the Trump 1.0 tax cuts, I think we'll get some spending cuts alongside. And indeed, so the White House have been pushing ahead unilaterally with the government of Department of Efficiency. Some of that will get approved by Congress, so it gets kind of coded in legislation. But the net effect is probably not much of a stimulus. If anything, you may get a slight drag from fiscal policy. And that then leaves you only with regulation and deregulation to try and really push the growth agenda forward. But I don't think this is going to be a huge effect. It's not like the US economy is massively overregulated to begin with. And the stuff they're doing on energy, okay, let's put aside some of the climate concerns. It really is up to the private sector to decide on levels of investment. And if oil prices are low, that's not going to encourage more drilling for shale oil. So I'm quite negative here. And I think that the risks are skewed towards further growth disappointment in the weeks and months ahead.
Thank you, Tim. That's a really useful outline of what might happen and why it's just so difficult, given all of the uncertainty at this moment, to be that confident on forecasts, etc. I know we're going to touch on the fiscal side later in the call as well that you've mentioned, but now is a great time to bring Jason into the call, and it's really good to have you here from Chicago to offer US perspective here. So Jason, what's your take on the macro picture, and how does this affect the outlook for US credit?
Yeah, thanks for having me. I mean, I think that currently there's an additional dimension to the complexity of the macro environment. Our investment framework asks two important questions. What are our views on the macro, and what is currently priced into markets? Now more than any point in the last few years, answering that second question is much more difficult. For example, if I knew for a fact that after the dust settled, the US would end up with 10% tariffs on Canada and Mexico, I wouldn't have an immense conviction about whether we should be buying or selling risk today. Contrast this to a market focused on inflation or the unemployment rate, where economic consensus is just a few clicks away on a Bloomberg terminal. It's unusually difficult right now to gauge investor consensus around tariffs, as there's so many moving pieces and headlines every day. It makes it increasingly difficult for us to position portfolios. One thing that is for certain, however, is that compared to the investor psychology coming into the year, the distribution of outcomes for the US has grown wider, with much fatter tails. And that's even demonstrated by the Fed's summary of economic projections released last week. In terms of what we are able to measure, I'll echo some of Tim's sentiments. We do believe that the recent downward revisions for US growth have not fully captured the impacts from the Trump administration. We anticipate that there will be some momentum in economists' mark-to-market growth forecasts as they begin to incorporate some of these second-order impacts of tariffs and DOGE. There's often an autocorrelation in economists' downward revisions. So that means that oftentimes they will understate the magnitude of the revision on their first publication, and typically subsequent revisions will be revised further downwards. Listening to earnings calls and sell-side analyst reports on US companies, most of the analysts and companies are not factoring in tariffs into their expectations, given the vast uncertainty. Once there's more clarity on tariffs and where we're going to end up, we do expect that earnings forecasts for the second half especially to be revised a lot lower, given that they're currently at pretty lofty double-digit evaluations. So while the recent hard data that we've seen for February has been mildly supportive for risk assets and has abated some of the fears around a growth scare, we believe that the impacts from the Trump administration are not fully priced in to economists and analyst forecasts, and which in turn is likely leading to credit spreads being overvalued at current time.
Well, thank you for talking us through those dynamics, Jason. It sounds like you're very much in the Drayson camp there. I think in the kind of the slightly more bearish view of the outlook. Colin, back in December, you suggested that politicians would be far more important this year for fixed income investors than central bankers. I think it's fair to say that view is holding up. You also memorably talked about the dangers around fiscal incontinence. How is your team managing these risks?
Short answer, Max, is with difficulty. I've said it before and I'll say it again. Markets have always been terrible at both pricing or providing a hedge for geopolitical risks in all their sort of many, many flavors. One of the best historical examples is that the day Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated, gilt yields actually rose. And I don't know of anyone who feels confident in measuring then actually trading geopolitical risk. And that's probably a good thing, actually, because confidence in an area where you have no right to have confidence is actually a very dangerous thing in markets, in large part because it's so varied in how it surfaces. Gold is always seen as the sort of universal hedge against uncertainty. So may implied volatility measures, but you know, beyond that, there are different potential trades. But I mean, loading up on a range of tail risk hedges is actually quite costly. When by definition, you know, tail risks, or most tail risks, tend not to actually eventuate. That's why they're tail risks. What I do hear is that, you know, many of the large funds are investing in sort of geopolitical expertise to add to the investment process and the debate, but how much that's improved returns is up for debate. We do subscribe to commentators who spend all day, every day on this topic. It's absolutely fascinating, don't get me wrong, but it's very noisy. And what your job is to try and spot the signal within the noise. More noise doesn't actually help. If you have a global investment opportunity set, I can see merit in greater diversification across borders. That's easier in equities than credit, though. And it probably relies as much on a sort of continuation of the last 2 months' powerful rotation away from US equities towards the rest of the world. Europe in particular, as Sonia's already sort of touched upon. And you can file this under the, of course you would say this, but I do think that good active management can help mitigate some of these risks. Active tends to thrive on differences in opinion. And you know, let's not forget that every seller needs a buyer and every buyer needs a seller.
Thank you, Colin. That was a very long-term view there. And I'm detecting a theme in looking for the signal amid all the noise. There's a lot of noise right now. Sonia, against this quite murky backdrop, what's the outlook for global equities?
There's definitely a lot of noise in equities, in a few signals. So let's see what this means for the outlook for the rest of the year and longer term. Rotation away from the US, I think that's a key feature. And it's very interesting if you believe the wise Davos crowd, then it was very clear that it could not have been more positive towards the US this year and more negative towards Europe. So if you want to be a contrarian, there might have been something in there that would have given you some indication on what's at play here. And we have seen, of course, a rotation away from the US towards Europe and China. So it is the rest of the world, it's not just Europe. And that's quite important because it's very clear that this idea of exceptionalism was versus the rest of the world. And we are now seeing that might well be questioned and revisited in the way not to reverse it. That is very important. We're not seeing the US falling off the cliff, but was the negativity towards the rest of the world justified? And coming to Europe, we of course have seen the election in Germany since, and we have seen a remarkable shift in the stance towards fiscal within the German government. And we have seen an even more fascinating twist in the way how a recent spending package has been pushed through before the new government even has been formed. That is remarkable. And it's remarkable being German, talking about a change in the attitude towards fiscal that we had probably hoped for, but not necessarily expected. So There is, of course, still a lot of outstanding features how the trillion will be spent. And it's important to say as well that Germany can definitely accommodate this because it's by far the G7 country with the lowest debt level overall. And of course, you know, yes, you can add it without breaking the bank here. But it's still, of course, a signal. And you have seen quite a lot of excitement on the back of this. But again, you have seen that shift in the narrative around a more joined up approach across Europe with an approach that would allow other European countries to raise defense spending. So I think it's been the overall negativity that nothing can happen in Europe that all of a sudden is questioned, because quite a lot has happened actually since the beginning of the year. And it's important as well that the German fiscal package is not just for defense, but there's a broader package within that that will focus on structural investment that, again, has been long talked about. But we might finally see something positive on the back of this. So the reason why I'm going as far and talking about this is because, of course, you could argue that with the flurry of executive orders and all of a sudden the reality check that there might be more negativity in some of the policy announcement than originally priced. Has this been just, you know, oh my God, let's, you know, shift away from the US with no reason, just into other regions where, of course, valuation has been more supportive? Or is there more in terms of the fundamental story for the other regions that might mean that the equity story in particular is more sustainable in these? And this is where, of course, the fiscal program is incredibly important, because to understand whether this can translate into higher economic growth than expected so far, that might well be the piece that will allow those parts of the market to continue to perform. For the time being, it is still a rotation. So again, investors will wait and see whether the economic momentum can, point one, continue to accelerate in Europe. Point two, whether the deceleration in the US, you know, what's the magnitude of this? Because that will drive to some extent investor appetite and how to diversify and where to invest. We know, and this was another feature that we've talked about at the end of last year, that never in history before we have seen more investors globally to put money to work in just one country. So again, you know, every buyer needs a seller, every seller needs a buyer. So we did question already, where's the incremental buyer coming from towards the US, whereas of course negativity in the rest of the world has been so low, as so high, that it's easy to see where an incremental buyer can come from. The rotation within markets is interesting as well. Definitely in the US, more towards defensive parts of the market, because again, I think you can hide in areas of the market until you know where the uncertainty will lead us. Equities, at the end of the day, are a very clear reflection of economic momentum and EPS. And the more we will see the swing in the underlying fundamentals translate into EPS changes and forecasts, you will see the market react. We have been more negative. We've reduced our risk in equity markets, and we have, as Jason has just highlighted, we are more bearish in terms of credit spreads and the opportunities that are there. I'm now generalizing. Of course, there is opportunities if you looked at it from a global spectrum, but you have to acknowledge where you find the least valuation support and be mindful on the asymmetry in risk and risk return profiles across different markets. So I think it's a long way of saying that it's not very clear. The level of uncertainty means diversification will be your friend, and you need to understand where the downside risk is the highest and where valuations will not support you. And as I said right in my introduction, a recession is not priced. So do not believe that the initial correction has already been a reflection that investors think that there's a recession coming in the US.
Thanks, Sonia. So a rotation with some very big dependencies. Colin, what are you hearing from clients? How are they reacting to news flow? And what strategies are they most interested in right now?
Yeah, I will I'll defer to Jason to cover US client activity and interests. But maybe if I cover off some of the other regions. Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, has obviously just sat down having given her her spring statement, but it was noticeable when gilt yields spiked at the time of our first budget back in late October. UK clients, especially in the wholesale channel, really lent in to higher yields. And that was the first time we'd seen that. When yields were moving higher, you know, a few years back for the first time, there was genuine reticence because nobody had seen it for so long. Late October, early November, two-year gilts went from 4 to 4.5 in just a handful of sessions and a fairly uncomfortable move. So that was, I think, revealing and probably suggests that clients at the headline level are getting more comfortable with yields at these levels. Europe is variations on the same theme, but with local nuance, which Sonia's already touched upon. They're a little bit more on the sidelines from an institutional standpoint, which is understandable, I think, given recent headlines. Trump's focus on Europe, the situation, the knock-on implications for Russia, Ukraine, and I wouldn't underestimate the significance of the single largest daily rise in 10-year bund yields since German reunification in 1990. In releasing the handbrake, they've joined the fiscal as fab club, and there was a 30 basis points move on the day. I think France was even higher. So, you know, for low vol markets like that, these are big moves. So I can get it's almost like they're a little bit behind the UK, you know, having gone through our own sort of crises earlier. Asia, they seem to be rotating into fixed income for stability, attractive yields, prospect of central bank easing. Interestingly, there's a strong preference for active, you know, signaling that they think careful credit selection, duration, position and management is all critical in the current sort of market volatility. There also seems to be a focus on global to try and sort of diversify away from those trade and geopolitical risks, and a bias for sort of more unconstrained fixed income strategies, probably for similar reasons. Japan is very interesting. There's no evidence yet of any sort of major shift in allocations, but they're about to commence the new financial year next week. So we'll, you know, their asset allocation changes tend to be seasonal around that. We're expecting to see a continued shift into privates, along with a lot of other clients. The volatility is clearly unwelcome in that market, maybe more so than others. So strategies that help them diversify market risk are in focus. Very interestingly, though, given it's Japan, you know, there is a talk of the return of the time value of money, you know, that savings products might possibly make a return or a comeback, you know, with rates expected to stay higher for longer. Now, given that's Japan, I think that's quite revealing. And I'll hand over to Jason for the US perspective.
Yeah, well, thank you, Colin. That's a really interesting kind of world tour of client views. And Jason, it would be great if you could share what you're hearing from US clients, and if you could also talk us through how your team is positioning right now, where you see opportunities as well as risks.
Sure, and those kind of tie together nicely. A lot of clients right now, and for the last year and a half, have really been asking about how tight long credit spreads are, and if it's a good time to be putting cash to work into long credit. So we pride ourselves on being able to generate alpha in all types of markets and, you know, all throughout the cycle, but we have been steering clients maybe a little bit away from long credit and into either shorter duration credit portfolios, or even some sort of combination of credit and government benchmarks. A lot of clients have been moving into an intermediate credit, so that's 1 to 10 year maturities, or even into SOFR related benchmarks with no duration, where the spread risk is much lower and they're able to collect carry income, but then, you know, just waiting for a better entry point into long credit. In terms of our positioning, so in those shorter duration portfolios where carry accounts for a substantial proportion of excess returns and the breakevens are quite high, we are overweight risk to pick up that carry. In our longer duration portfolios, we are more cautiously positioned with a beta slightly below 1 and a barbelled approach into credit quality. So on the riskier end of that barbell, we heavily rely on our bottoms-up analyst team to identify wider trading names with catalysts for spread compression and tempered or capped downside risks. And on the higher quality end, we offset these higher beta names by holding treasuries, which results in an approximately beta neutral portfolio with ample dry powder on hand. So given the current valuations and the diminished impact of carry in long duration portfolios, so that the precise timing of index level spread moves is less important, we're happy to wait for a better entry point before we put our money to work into long credit. And we do expect to see a better entry point in the coming months. And at that time, we will have dry powder ready to deploy to take portfolios overweight risk. So in other words, our portfolios are pretty well set up for dip buying, a strategy that worked very well in Trump's first term, especially around tariff announcements. To get more granular in the portfolios, we see a lot of value near the 10-year point in terms of higher quality names. The recent sell-off, we've actually seen compression where triple Bs on a beta adjusted basis have outperformed higher quality. So as Sonia mentioned, we certainly have seen a rotation in the recent sell-off, but not a rotation that I would say is indicative of people pricing in recession risks. So with that, you need to go back to 2005 before you'd see triple Bs trading this tight relative to a median A-rated issuer when spreads are in the current zip code. So there's also very limited upside in terms of that relationship by historical standards, but significant room for decompression should growth continue to surprise to the downside. And we can use the already mentioned barbell approach to enter into that trade without giving up carry in the meantime while we wait for the decompression to occur.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Jason. Let's turn now to Tim for our kind of final question of the regular part of the podcast, which is actually about the big pivot in Germany that Sonia mentioned. How much of a game changer do you think this is for the country and for the broader European economy as well?
So economists have been calling for Germany to ease the debt brake for years to revive the moribund European economy. And as Sonia pointed out, Germany is the one country with lots of fiscal space. In terms of the numbers, we think it's roughly 2 to 2.5% boost to German GDP. So that's pretty significant. Timing wise, it's probably not going to come quite as quickly as perhaps people are hoping, because it's a combination of infrastructure and defense. And building up the defense industry will take time. Infrastructure is notorious in terms of the planning which goes in before you can even start to put those shovels in the ground. So we don't really think there'll be much of an uplift to GDP this year. We did see a slight improvement in some of the confidence surveys, but there's going to be a lag. In the meantime, we've got to get through all the tariff noise, and that's going to be a challenge for Europe. You know, April the 2nd is a big day. We're going to see large reciprocal tariffs on Europe, potentially matching VAT levels. If that were to occur, that's really problematic, because I can't see Europe taking down their VAT rates. If it's just a one-for-one on existing tariffs, then there may be scope for some negotiation. And this will be a negative for European growth if we do see these more severe tariffs. But you know, overall, Germany joining the fiscal fab club is a good thing. And once we kind of get through the tariffs, then hopefully we'll see better growth and inflation kind of round target and more normal interest rates after a decade of weakness.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Tim. It's quite a crowded club, I think, that fiscal is found.
Very popular.
Very popular indeed. Sonia, as we always do, we've covered a lot of ground just now. What are the key takeaways for investors?
Clearly understand where the Fiscalist Fab Club is and who the newest member is. I think that's what we've learned year to date. But joking aside, it's very clear that the level of uncertainty persists and there's no end in sight. And I think that what Tim just highlighted just gives you an indication the different scenarios that you need to consider in order to understand what the near and then the mid and long-term implications are for Europe and for Germany, just looking at this case. And this is even before you have started considering the various outcomes for the US, and we haven't even talked about China much. Hence, what is very important, I think Jason called this out very clearly, and Colin as well, is understand where your risks are. Where are you not compensated for the risks you're taking? Where would valuation let you down? Where would you experience the most asymmetric risk return profile if your negative or worst case scenario occurs? That's the most important understanding that investors need to have. And that's why it's not surprising if you look at the US development, a lot of investors are waking up to the concentration risk they're having in the US. So understanding all of this is not relatively, it's not straightforward, but I think it's probably the most useful exercise that you should do right now. And both Colin and Jason have outlined, of course, opportunity sets, because it's not that the risk is not spread evenly and valuation levels differ greatly across, of course, regions and markets, but even within markets, as Jason in particular has highlighted. And hence, point one, having dry powder, as Jason has highlighted, making sure that there is a clear understanding on when to pull the trigger, i.e. what you're waiting for and what are you currently compensated for, so where might you find opportunities in a potential sell-off. And of course, as Colin has said, diversification will be your friend, because navigating uncertainty, we can't do with certainty. So you will have to prepare for varying degrees of changes in the narrative throughout the year. And there is a degree of humbleness and a degree of nimbleness required in order to navigate this. But I think understanding the risk you're taking right now is probably the most useful takeaway from today's call.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that, Sonia. And now, finally, I'd like to ask, in the most popular part of these calls, what you've been watching, reading, or listening to recently. I will get the ball rolling and say, my wife and I just had a new child, our second daughter. She's almost 2 months old. We've been watching The Leopard on Netflix. As a great way of sort of thinking about all of the chaos that comes with a sometimes screaming infant. Tim, over to you.
I'm currently watching Miami Open Tennis. I'm also watching White Lotus.
Jason?
Currently watching March Madness Basketball, but then I'm picking up The House of Huawei, which is a book that just recently came out that explores how Huawei rose to global prominence, its ties to the Chinese government, and the geopolitical battles with the US.
Thank you. And Colin?
So I'm reading, just to raise the standards a tad. While I wait for news on when, who the next James Bond film will be announced and start filming, given the recent transfer of ownership rights to Amazon, I'm reading the latest Ian Fleming biography, which is just utterly fascinating. I just found out that his grandfather was Robert Fleming of Robert Fleming & Co, the merchant bank. I had absolutely no idea that's where we had come from, born in the slums of Dundee. Not far from my place. That's me.
Fascinating. Thank you. And Sonia?
Two things. Watching very light, no, not lightheartedly, but very cool, actually. So all of you will have watched the Beckham, a session on the season on Netflix, right? And there's now a Thomas Müller version, who's the, of course, the German footballer, which my son and I are watching. And then staying with a German theme, I'm reading a book from Wolfgang Münchau, who is a FT journalist, that's called Kaputt, and is going back through history where the German growth miracle failed. Absolutely fascinating and highly recommended.
Great. As always, a fantastic, eclectic set of recommendations, both high and lowbrow, for our listeners. Well, that's a great point on which to end today's call. Thank you, Sonia, Tim, Jason, and Colin, for your time today. And thank you to our clients for joining us. You'll be able to find our latest updates on our social media channels, our blog, and of course, here on our LNG Talks Asset Management podcast.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. The views expressed in this podcast are those of L&G's Asset Management Division, as at the date of publication. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and we're not soliciting any action based on it. The information discusses general market, economic or political issues, or industry or sector trends. It does not constitute research or investment, legal or tax advice. It is not recommendation or advertisement to buy or sell securities or pursue a particular investment strategy. Assumptions, opinions, and estimates are provided for illustrative purposes only. There is no guarantee that any forecast made will come to pass. No party shall have any right of action against L&G in relation to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Where this podcast contains third-party information, the accuracy or completeness of such information cannot be guaranteed, and we accept no responsibility or liability in respect of such information, not for distribution to any person in any jurisdiction where such distribution would be contrary to local law or regulations. Copyright 2025. Legal and General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Unless otherwise stated, references herein to L&G, we and us are meant to capture the global conglomerate that includes, in the European Economic Area, LGIM Managers Europe Limited, authorised and regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland as a UCITS management company pursuant to European Communities Undertaking for Collective Investment in Transferable Securities Regulations 2011 as amended, and as an Alternative Investment Fund Manager pursuant to the European Union Alternative Investment Fund Managers Regulations 2013 as amended. In the USA, Legal and General Investment Management America, Inc., a US SEC regulated investment advisor. In Japan, Legal and General Investment Management Japan, KK, a Japan FSA registered investment management company. In Hong Kong, issued by Legal and General Investment Management Asia Limited, which is licensed by the Securities and Futures Commission. And in Singapore, issued by LGIM Singapore Pte Limited, company registration number 20223187 6W, which is regulated by the Monetary Authority of Singapore. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on LinkedIn or on our website.